You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey there, folks. It's Ben Mathis here. In case you missed my big announcement the other day, I have some exciting news to share with you. We're starting a podcast network. This is something that's been a long time in the making, and now at last, in early May, we'll be launching our own network called Airwave. It'll be the new home for Kick-Ass News, as well as a number of your other favorite podcasts and brand new shows from some of the leading thought leaders and storytellers in audio entertainment, including podcasts from at least a dozen of my most popular past guests. We'll have 15 different podcasts at launch and plan to roll out over 40 shows in 2021. In the next few weeks, I'll be sharing more details about those specific shows, so subscribe to us on Twitter and Facebook at Airwave Podcasts. But in the meantime, I'm going to ask for your help. I'm putting a lot of my own money into covering the startup costs of this new venture, but we need additional financial support to cover our full production slate for 2021. So please visit GoFundMe.com/Airwave to contribute to what we're building here. That's GoFundMe.com/Airwave to donate. GoFundMe.com/Airwave. AIRWAVE. GoFundMe.com/Airwave. Thanks for your support and for listening all these years. When you imagine the world 13 years from now, what do you think of? Autonomous vehicles? Flying cars? Or maybe a smartphone implanted in your brain. But what about a naval clash between the U.S. and China in the South China Sea that leads to a nightmarish conflagration with staggering costs for both sides? 2034, a novel of the next world war, is a disturbingly plausible work of speculative fiction, co-authored by Elliot Ackerman, an award-winning novelist and decorated Marine veteran, and the former commander of NATO, James Stavridis, the legendary admiral who spent much of his career strategically outmaneuvering America's most tenacious adversaries. Written with a powerful blend of geopolitical sophistication and human empathy, 2034 takes us inside the minds of a global cast of characters, Americans, Chinese, Iranians, Russians, and Indians, as a series of arrogant miscalculations on all sides leads the world into an intensifying international storm. And today, I welcome the two of them back to the podcast to discuss how they came together on this project and the power of fiction to draw attention to real-world issues and potential areas of crisis in the not-too-distant future. The Admiral talks about China's increasingly aggressive moves in the South China Sea and how tensions in this region could potentially impact 30% of the world's shipping and be the flashpoint for the next world war. Plus, he reveals how the pandemic is altering the global balance of power, and Elliot lays out how America's political divisions may signal the end of the two-party system and weaken the U.S. against our adversaries. Coming up with James Stavridis and Elliot Ackerman in just a moment. At Admiral James Stavridis is a four-star retired admiral who served as the Supreme Allied Commander at NATO and previously as head of U.S. Southern Command. Elliot Ackerman is a former White House fellow and Marine who served five tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, where he received the Silver Star, the Bronze Star for Valor, and the Purple Heart. Now they've joined forces to write a military thriller that speculates about how current geopolitical fractures could spin out of control. It's called 2034, a novel of the next war. Gentlemen, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Well, this was a thrilling book, but it's also pretty chilling, some of the scenarios that you paint here. Elliot, I know that you've written a number of novels before, and James, you've written nine books, but this is your first work of fiction. How did you two come together on this project?
Well, it started with an idea that I had about 3 years ago, to write a novel. I've written nine books. This is my 10th book. Went to my editor, said, hey, I have an idea for a novel. What I wanted to write was a novel that would be a cautionary tale about how terrible it would be if the U.S. and China stumbled into a war. And the idea in my head was Cold War literature. So think the Third World War by Sir John Hackett, the Bedford Incident by Mark Raskovich, Failsafe, number of books like that, Doctor Strangelove, the film. It was cautionary. It was designed for a broad audience to read and say, boy, we better avoid a war with, in that case, the Soviet Union. My idea, we're headed toward a collision with China. How do we avoid it? So I went to my editor and said, I really want to write a novel. And he said, you know, Admiral, you're a great guy. We like your books a lot, but you're not a novelist. And I said, yes, I am. I can write a novel. And the bottom line is, he said, let me introduce you. I'll always remember this. He said, to a real novelist. And that would be Elliot Ackerman, who can now pick up the story from there.
So I Jim said's correct. You know, we already shared an editor at Penguin Press, Scott Moyers, and we knew one another. I am an alum of the Fletcher School, and obviously the Admiral was the dean there, and I was the writer in residence at the Fletcher School for a semester, just to give you some background. And during that semester, one of my collateral duties was to talk with the dean about books when he feels like it. So we had many conversations talking about books, and I very much knew what his sensibility was. So when Scott came to me, mentioned the idea, perhaps I'd want to work with Jim on this. I already knew who he was, and we had a relationship, and to me it sounded like a lot of fun. So we said, "Hey, let's see if we can write the first chapter," and we did, and very much had the same aligned visions on what the book could be, and the rest is history.
Okay, so let me ask you: does your shared alma mater supersede any Navy versus Marine rivalry? Do you guys still jab each other a little bit, or what?
I think we kept that off on the right and kind of united against larger foes like global war and right. I think maybe West Point.
The only thing I'll add to that is I grew up in the Marine Corps. My father was a career officer in the U.S. Marine Corps. I went to Quantico High School, so I know and love the Marine Corps. Mm. I've got two sides to me, kind of Marine and Navy. So, yeah, we get along wonderfully in that regard. Yeah. We're the Navy Marine Corps at sea team.
Now, 2034 involves many real-world and near-future challenges, some of which, James, you addressed in your previous book, Sea Power, particularly China's aggression in the South China Sea. What were you hoping to do by exploring many of these same issues in the form of a novel?
I'll tell you three things that fiction allows you to do, and in particular in this case, it allows you to imagine your way into the future without being completely constrained by hard facts everywhere along the path. Mm. And if you look at American history, we failed to imagine Pearl Harbor. We failed to imagine 9/11. We failed to imagine the pandemic. That failure of imagination has cost us. So point one is, by writing fiction, you can kind of imagine a very different future. Secondly, you can bring characters into it. You know, if I wrote a scholarly book about what's the future of the U.S.-China relationship, it just wouldn't be as interesting as the kind of stories that have real characters in them. Think how much you revere a novel like The Old Man and the Sea. Why? because of Santiago, because of that old fisherman. The character matters. And third and finally, you get a much bigger audience writing fiction. More people will read it, and hopefully we'll see the folly of stumbling into a war with China.
Yeah, and it is a wonderfully character-driven story that highlights the reality that really every political issue is just at its heart a human issue with very real consequences for everyday people. And I think that's so important because it's so easy for us in our gated planned communities with our iPhones and our 70-inch TVs to think that we're untouchable, we're invulnerable, and all of these matters are just nebulous ideas completely removed from our lives. But as you pointed out, that's probably what we thought before Pearl Harbor, and it's certainly the attitude that we had prior to 9/11. How quickly we forget, I guess.
Yeah, I'd say absolutely. And for me, one of the things that excited me as we collaborated on this project is, you know, in my work, I've always been very interested in sort of mapping the emotional topography of war, of politics, and all of this comes down to individuals, to the humans that are making these decisions. And so as much as, you know, 2034 is a book that deals with technology and deals with, you know, real politique like we see in the headlines, it also gets down into the level of individual characters and shows you how through individual miscalculation, you can stumble, a nation can stumble, nations can stumble into war. And that has always been the case in the past, and it will likely be the case in the future.
Yeah, think about Commodore Sarah Hunt at the beginning of the novel, who just becomes insistent that she's going to crack her way into this compartment on this Chinese ship. If she had made a different choice, we wouldn't have the novel 2034. Big doors swing so often on small hinges, and those small hinges are the human heart, the decisions that we make. By the way, do you have a 70-inch television? That's really cool.
No, but actually a relative just showed off their 77-inch television the other day to us. So that's why that comes to mind. Not me. I wish. Yeah. I'm curious, were there particular challenges for either you, James, in getting into this world of fiction and trying to write a novel, or even for Elliot? And, you know, this is, I guess, your first time collaborating with a relative neophyte to the novel game, huh?
Yeah, I think what really helped the two of us was we had a shared vision of what the project was about and what we were hoping to achieve in doing it. So I wish I could, you know, tell you great stories. If at the time, you know, we you know, threw a glass at one another and had our big arguments, but it really wasn't the case. We, you know, we conceived of the book. We knew we wanted something that had a very large global stage, but still retained the intimacy of a novel. When you got to the end of it, you know, you had traveled with, in our case, five characters, and really felt like you knew them and were emotionally invested with them, and had taken a journey with them through, you know, what is the novel's titular year, 2034.
Yeah, this is not, you know, War and Peace with 50 characters. It's not The Winds of War and War and Remembrance by Herman Woke with probably 25 major characters. It's shorter, it's tighter, because we really wanted to narrow that frame so that we could draw as many readers in and so that these characters could be just as memorable as absolutely possible. And I learned watching Elliot construct these characters. What I contributed up front was, I think, the big idea and then kind of a detailed outline. And after that, it was just the two of us going back and forth. What would she do? What would he do at this moment? But really, Elliot is a master at kind of constructing character and what I call the fit and finish of a novel. This thing really fits together well, I think.
Yeah, it's a wonderful collaboration, and it shows in the book. Now, as the title would indicate, your novel is set in 2034. Usually novels set in the future look toward a decade marker year, or set it 20, 10, 30 years out, a nice even number. Is there a particular significance in setting this book 13 years ahead in 2034?
I would just offer that, you know, the books I've written kind of generally fall into two categories. There are those books where the title has immediately presented itself, and the other category, which is when you haven't known the title till right towards the end. And 2034 certainly falls in the latter category. And I'll spare you all the iterations of lesser titles that we did not choose. But something that did occur in the book is, as we were writing it, we actually started out with a date that was much further in the future. But the more and more we imagine these events and imagined how everything would transpire, we realized that, you know, kind of like a tide inching up a beach, like this was much closer to us than we thought. And as the year kept changing, it presented us that actually the year would be the title of the novel. And, you know, with regards to that year, I think by having it closer to us, you know, we weren't trying to fixate on every little technological difference that will exist. You know, will there be 100% autonomous cars on the street in the year 2034? Will it be 25%? Or, you know, a lot of that, those are sort of broader, they're distractions. Because listen, whether or not there are autonomous cars or drones delivering us our milk in the morning, human beings are going to remain the same. And the focus of this book is on humans and how they behave. And we didn't want a story that, although you see there are many futuristic elements, we didn't want a story that overly distracted from that.
I'll only add that, you know, one of the great novels of the 20th century was simply A Year, 1984, by George Orwell. And that was, to my knowledge anyway, not a signpost kind of moment. And it worked out pretty well. Mm-hmm. The other example of that would be 2001, A Space Odyssey by Stanley Kubrick, who also wrote, by the way, Dr. Strangelove, which was in my mind. But yeah, I like 2034. I've kind of come around to it. And I think it's also when we were writing the novel, it was 15 years in the future. Just publication date and cycle of book, it's now 13 years in the future.
Now, before we get to the action that takes place in this novel, set the scene for us, either one of you, if you will. What does America and the world look like in 2034?
I'll take a crack at that. I think that the United States has continued to decline relative to other great powers from where we are at present. And that's, I think, indisputable. China will rise. And that's the other major feature of the landscape. China has risen, become more assertive, has more command of technologies, notably cyber, stealth, other military technologies. India has developed more rapidly than some would have expected. Those are the three big geopolitical muscle movements. We should also observe that China has drawn closer to Iran. That's something that we're seeing happening right now. And Russia continues to be essentially as they are today, kind of a spoiler on the international scene with, by the way, an octogenarian Vladimir Putin still running the country. So that's the setup.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. Now, much of the action in 2034 is centered around the South China Sea. For any listeners who might not have listened to my previous interview with Admiral Stavridis about his book Sea Power, or maybe aren't particularly well-versed in the politics of the region, why is the South China Sea so important?
It's because it's a vast water space, the size of the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean Sea combined. It's full of hydrocarbons, oil, natural gas. Almost 40% of the world's shipping passes through it. And it's particularly important because today, China claims it as territorial waters in its entirety. It would be as though the United States were claiming territorial sovereignty over the entire Gulf of Mexico and Caribbean Sea. And China takes this very seriously today, and there is no reason to doubt that they will continue to want control of those waters. The United States, on the other hand, firmly believes that these are international waters, high seas. Every nation has an equal right to pass through these waters. The vast majority of our allies agree with us on this. I think that's the central point of disagreement between the two nations that could, with a miscalculation, create the spark that leads to a war, as we describe in 2034.
Now, I confess that I have a little bit of ignorance about something here. Usually, when nations make a territorial claim, there's some history there of ethnic or cultural ties to the region that they use as justification, however superficial. I guess that there must be a reason that it's called the South China Sea. So what is China's history there, and what is their support for that claim?
Excellent question. And their support for the claim goes back to a Chinese admiral, Zheng He, who sailed in the early 1600s. China sent enormous fleets abroad. They operated extensively through those waters. And China claims that that was the beginning of their sovereignty. I have a PhD in international law, and my focus in particular is on the law of the sea treaty and maritime law. I'm shall we say, conversant in these issues. The claim will not hold water in international law. And the principal reason is, sure, it's true that a Chinese fleet sailed through these waters, but China didn't do the other things that arguably might have allowed them to claim it as territorial seas. They never conquered the Philippines. They never conquered any of the nations around the periphery of the South China Sea. They simply sailed through them, did trade with the nations of the Indian Ocean, and sailed back. And then in the intervening 400 years to the present, they have not established significant control over these waters. They haven't consistently operated on them. They haven't consistently made these claims. They haven't had much opportunity to, in fairness, because they've been repeatedly invaded, conquered by others, and fought a series of internal wars. So it is an unsupportable claim in international law. And don't listen to Admiral Stavridis. The Chinese brought the claims to the international courts, and they were firmly dismissed. Mm-hmm. So it's not a claim that will stand. China is going to try to make it a de facto claim by building artificial islands, operating throughout the waters, constantly proclaiming their ownership of them. That's a point of contention, again, that with a miscalculation could create a spark that could lead to war.
And Elliot, as a storyteller, what did you find appealing about what's going on in that region and the potential for a conflict down the road?
Well, as the Admiral said, you know, it's an area where there's a potential for massive miscalculations. So, you know, as a writer and a storyteller, it was very appealing to me because it allowed you to really get in there and try to break down, okay, how would a reasonable person, reasonable people, frankly, make these series of miscalculations that would lead us into a massively destructive world war. And when you think about it, miscalculation itself is hard-baked into every single war that's fought because both sides assume that they're going to win the war. So obviously one side has miscalculated. And so really taking that all the way down to the level of individual characters, you know, it's just always a pleasure for me and getting down in the weeds and figuring out, okay, what is every single thing that's going to happen so that a reader following along with these characters would see how their decisions, at least from that the perspective of the character, are totally rational, but they lead you to this very irrational action, which is a world war in the case of the novel.
Yeah, and it really highlights that it's never one decision that does it. It's always a death by a thousand cuts over months or years that get us into a crisis like this.
It's always accretive.
Indeed. Yeah. And it's also, as Elliot said earlier, it's a series of small miscalculations, individual scenes that go wrong. There's a scene in the book where a couple of staffers at the National Security Council staff have knowledge that they think would reverse the decision and cause the president to change her mind. Yet they're blocked by the senior staffer there. I don't want to give away too much of the book. It's a very pivotal scene. Elliot and I both worked in and around the National Security Council staff. Very realistic.
Well, the conventional wisdom has always been that the economic relationship between the U.S. and China was, for lack of a better term, too big to fail. In other words, the economic incentives and entanglements are so great that it would be in neither interest to ever get into a war. Does that assumption still hold true at this point?
Absolutely not. History tells us again and again that nations that are deeply entwined often end up going to war. The principal historical example is only 100 years ago, where a rising power, the Kaiser's Germany, is deeply entwined in trade, in blood relationships between the ruling families with the established power of the time, the United Kingdom. The Kaiser was the grand nephew of Queen Victoria. There was no way they would go to war. Besides which, they were kind of constitutional democracies, if you will, and they were all enlightened. There were a whole series of books written almost exactly 100 years ago about why a war, a world war, or war between these powers was simply impossible. And by the way, they were busy carving up the rest of the world in colonial efforts. So why would they go to war in Europe? Well, how did that turn out? They managed to sleepwalk into World War I, and you can drop a plumb line from World War I to the rise of fascism and the Second World War. The total butcher's bill is probably 80 million people from a society that could never go to war because of the trade relationships and the intermarriages, and they're all civilized people, and everyone spoke French, the diplomatic language of the time. I think history shows us we better work at this or we are going to sleepwalk into another.
Well, China appears to be weathering the COVID crisis better than the U.S. and much of the West. And since the pandemic began, China has taken a far more heavy-handed approach to protesters in Hong Kong, made aggressive moves in the South China Sea, and stepped up its saber-rattling toward Taiwan. Do either of you have any doubt that Xi Jinping and the Chinese communist leaders see the pandemic as a net positive for them?
Oh, absolutely. Their economy will be the so-called V, you know, went down sharply, but then came right back. They've managed the pandemic better than any other nation, large nation, as in President Xi is in an assertive mood because he's consolidating power quite successfully. He's drawing on the forces and the ideas of nationalism to do so. And by the way, I'll add to your excellent list of places where you see that assertiveness also at the top of the world, the Himalayas. Between India and China, again, an element in the book of India. So look for China to come out of the blocks running fast as us are gaining speed through 2021 and 2022.
Now, looking not just at China, but America's relationship with other adversaries as well as allies alike, how do you think COVID is impacting the global balance of power?
Give you a quick snapshot. China up, Europe neutral, developing world slowing down, but fortunately it's a young population. So I think might be better than you would otherwise in South Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America. Mm-hmm. I think Russia declining, it's taking a hit in pretty much every mention, will continue to play the spoiler role. Iran afflicted by it, but it won't slow them down. And I'd be surprised if we don't see something dramatic from Kim over the next 30 to 60 days. He needs to emerge. But broadly speaking, the better, without question, China.
Now, Elliot, this novel envisions an America that by 2034 has seen the demise of the two-party system. I suppose some would look at, say, the UK and Germany and other multi-party democracies and say, you know, it works pretty well for them. If anything, they seem more immune to instability and wild political swings. So I wonder what's wrong with that?
So, you know, specific to U.S. politics, if you think about Europe, we have different political systems. Europe, by and large, has a parliamentary political system, and we do not. You know, our elections are first past the post. So by definition, they are winner-take-all elections, and that forces American politics into a two-party system. And, you know, we've seen right now that a two-party system can become subject to the type of hyper-partisanship that defines so much of American political life. So what we did when imagining what domestic political life would look like in the United States in the year 2034, we kind of took current trends and brought them into the future. And one of those trends is a level of political dysfunction that eventually evolves to a political independent and a woman being elected president.
We've had Whigs, Federalists, Nationalists, Progressives. That was the actual name of the party, so-called name of Theodore Roosevelt, which, by the way, was hardly progressive line of what we think of today. It was actually a center-right party. I think the country is getting riper and riper for a new political party. And I think it would be good for American democracy because what we have now is increasing control of both parties by hard left and hard right elements. I don't think that's good for the country.
Now, the recent freeze in Texas has exposed vulnerabilities in the power grid, and the pandemic likewise has laid bare many weaknesses in supply chains and medical emergency capabilities. Do you think this was the wake-up call that we need to harden this country against the kind of black swan events that you describe in 2034?
I don't. The Texans will remember it for another couple of months, but I think it's the kind of seminal cyber Pearl Harbor that people are talking about. For something like that to happen, I think you'd have to knock off half the U.S. electric grid. That would get everyone's attention. What happened in Texas, you could think of it as a bit of a canary in the coal mine, a bit of a warning cloud, but I don't think it was big enough to penetrate the American collective psyche. And in fact, look at the pandemic. We've got 550,000 dead Americans, and we're still arguing about whether to wear a mask or not. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. Well, hopefully people pay attention and pay attention to this book. Before we go, do you guys think you might write another book together?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
I would jump at the chance to do it. And you know, we talked about 1984 before. How about 2084?
I like to tell people challenging and difficult themes. We sure had a lot of fun.
Yeah, and it's a lot of fun to read. Well, again, the book is called 2034, A Novel of the Next World War. James Stavridis and Elliot Ackerman, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks so much.
Take care.
Being with you, man.
Thanks again to Elliot and James for coming on the podcast. Order their new book, 2034, A Novel of the Next World War, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Be sure to follow Elliot at ElliotAckerman.com and on Twitter at ElliotAckerman, and follow James at AdmiralStav.com and on Twitter at StavridisJ. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.